Today is Monday, July 17th. We're going to work on more urinary system information and begin fluid electrolyte balance.
Okay, so in class on Wednesday of last week after our test, we had labeled that nephron on page 111, and we were talking about nephron structure on page 104. So I'd like to hit that one more time before we keep moving forward. There's actually two portions to your typical nephron. There's an area called the renal corpuscle, and then there's an area called the renal tubule. What structures should we find in the renal corpuscle? And the Bowman's capsule, good. So glomerulus is a knot of capillaries right here, and it's surrounded by a capsule called the Bowman's capsule. Okay, so typical capillaries are thin-walled. They are great for exchange because they're thin-walled. But this is a different set of capillaries. This particular set is built so that we maintain high pressure and don't allow for reabsorption. So what we're looking for is a slightly different setup for this glomerulus. In fact, you'll notice there is an afferent arteriole that feeds the glomerular capillaries. What drains the capillary bed?
Efferent.
Efferent, good. So another arteriole actually drains this capillary bed. Is that the norm for what you see with capillaries? What do you normally see? Yeah, arterial feeding capillary bed and a venule draining the capillary bed. So it's that drop in pressure that we saw that normally allows for reabsorption of those fluids. But that's not what we're looking for here. We actually want to maintain the filtration process. That's why we have arterioles both feeding and draining that arterial set up in the capillary bed. The other portion of your nephron includes this tubule system. The portion of the tubule system closest to your glomerulus is called what?
The proximal convoluted tube.
Good. Okay, and then from there we travel down a hairpin curve called?
Loop of Henle.
Good. And then we travel through another set of twisted tubes known as?
Convoluted tube.
Good. And then we drain into a collecting tube or collecting duct, and that, of course, drips from the tips of our renal pyramids. Those tips are known as? Renal papillae, good. And they drain into little grooves known as minor calyces, good. They drain into a larger set of grooves called?
Major.
Good. And from there, where do we travel?
Renal pelvis.
Renal pelvis, good. And from there, we travel down a large tube?
Ureter,
good. And then we are held in the?
Bladder,
good. And then, of course, exit through the?
Urethra,
good. There you go. You've got to trace them down, Pat. Okay. So we talked a little bit in class last Wednesday about this renin-angiotensin mechanism. I'd like to review that by looking at the JGA, which is a specialized set of cells sitting between your afferent and efferent arterioles. So looking at the big picture, you'll notice that this nephron actually gives itself a hug. There's a piece of the DCT that winds right up against this afferent and efferent arteriole, and wedged in between the DCT and those arterioles is a triangular region of cells known as the JGA. So when we zoom in, let me get you a picture. Ah, that's a good one. You'll notice this little special region of cells here are sitting close to the glomerulus. They're right up against the DCT, and it is their job to detect blood pressure. So what we're looking for is a way to maintain blood pressure and get rid of the filtrate and the nasty toxins that may be in our bloodstream. So is the biggest issue for us high pressure or low pressure?
Low
pressure. Yeah, why is low pressure probably our bigger concern? You can't push all that filtrate and those toxins out. So if we have low pressure, these JGA cells sitting in that little area will detect that low pressure issue, and they in turn release a chemical known as?
Renin.
Renin, good. So take me through it. Where does renin go next?
The liver.
To the liver, good. It turns on the release of angiotensin 1. What now happens? Good. ACE converts you to angiotensin 2. ACE, by the way, is an enzyme. It stands for angiotensin converting enzyme. Once you get angiotensin 2, you now have a very potent vasoconstrictor. How does that help our problem? Good. It's a constrictor. It squeezes vessels. If you squeeze a vessel, your blood pressure goes up. Okay. That's part of fixing the problem. But there's a second half that you guys mentioned, and that is the release of aldosterone and ADH. Good. Both cause water retention. Okay. And so that water retention is what we're looking for to help increase blood volume. This is a great review for us because back when we covered blood pressure, what was the number one determinant of blood pressure? CO, yeah, cardiac output. Good. So cardiac output's your number one determinant of blood pressure. The way you manipulate that is by increasing blood volume through increasing water retention. So we're really thinking big picture here in terms of our water retention. So yeah, that takes you full circle. Let's go back to our flow chart. Renin comes from the JGA cells, targets the liver. The liver then turns on the release of angiotensin 1. ACE converts it to angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 is a squeezer. It increases blood pressure. And then finally, you get aldosterone and ADH. They retain water. And of course, that's going to help us maintain blood pressure. So this is going to be a full circle negative feedback mechanism. Like I mentioned to you last week, this is a guaranteed essay question for test number 4. The question says something like, describe the angiotensin, renin angiotensin mechanism as a way to maintain or regulate blood pressure. I wouldn't necessarily memorize the words here. Put it to something that's easiest for you to remember and make sense of it. Okay? So if you choose to, that one is a 4-point essay on test number 4. All right, so that takes us near the bottom of page 104. How about questions on that review material? After test time, I almost hate to teach anything because it's like, phew.
It made a lot more sense today.
Good. Anybody still need the slide? So while you guys are copying this down, I just want to talk about some issues with this flow pathway. Some people take medications called ACE inhibitors. They are drugs that help to lower blood pressure. So how do they work? What exactly do they stop? Bingo. It stops the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. Yeah, and if you stop that conversion, you don't get the powerful vasoconstrictive effects of angiotensin 2. What else do you stop from happening? Yeah, you stop that release. Good, retaining water. Yeah, you stop that. So, in effect, you actually lower blood pressure by letting your vessels stay relaxed. You don't release aldosterone and ADH, so your vessels don't get filled with blood and fluids that increase pressure. Good. Anybody still need this slide? Okay. Bottom of page 104 illustrates two different types of nephrons. They are called cortical and juxtamedullary. Actually, they're named on their locations. You'll notice these cortical nephrons sit, guess where? In the cortex. Yep. So they tell you where they're located. And juxta means near. So we've got juxtamedullary nephrons that sit near or actually predominantly in the medulla. So I want you to look at the difference between the two nephron loops. The cortical nephron has a very short nephron loop. The juxtamedullary has a really long nephron loop. I should tell you that the nephron loop is a place where you can reabsorb water back into the bloodstream. So thinking about that, which one of these do you think makes more dilute, light-colored urine? Cortical. Yeah, cortical makes dilute, light-colored urine. How come? Why that one? You don't have a very long tube there, right? The longer the tube, the more water you reabsorb. So yeah, light-colored dilute urine is made here in the cortical nephron. This long tube here is going to have an awesome opportunity to reabsorb fluids and therefore you actually make a more concentrated dark yellow urine. So pressure regulates where we're going here. Most of our nephrons are going to be in the cortical region up here, but nonetheless, we have an opportunity to regulate which one of these does the main filtration process. The first one, that's right. Okie doke, so that does it for page 104. How about questions so far? So how are you doing with blood flow? Okay. Feeling good?
We have to be feeling good by Wednesday.
Got to be feeling good by Wednesday. Okay. So instead of memorizing a list, I think looking at a picture can be really helpful. So why don't we look at this picture? And we're going to work our way through the kidney. I have a disclaimer first. If you go to the library and pick up any anatomy and physiology textbook, I guarantee they're going to have a different flow path for you. They apparently cannot agree on how the vessels work in the kidney. There must be a lot of variability from one person to the next. So just want to put that out there, that different textbooks are going to give you different names of vessels and different flow plans. It is interesting to note, though, that as you're forming as a fetus before you're born, you actually make your kidneys about three times. The body reabsorbs them and then makes them again. And you end up with the final set of kidneys that are being made. Obviously, that developmental process gives us an opportunity to have a lot of variability in the way those vessels are set up. So we're going to start by branching off the aorta with this renal artery. That renal artery branches into around five segmental arteries. Good. Those segmental arteries branch again into what?
Interlobar.
Interlobar. Good. Those interlobar arteries will finally branch into a set of?
Arcuate.
Good. Now I want you to notice these are located at the bases of your pyramids. Every one of these arcuate arteries lays at the base of your pyramid all the way around. Okay? And then the final artery of our five is this one that radiates toward the cortex, known as?
Cortical radiate
artery. Good. The old name for it is interlobular artery. It is your choice to use that one or cortical radiate. Just a caution, if you do use interlobular, because it sounds a lot like interlobar, and there's a point of confusion with the spelling there. Let me flip you off to a different picture. You can see again the arcuate arteries at the base of the pyramid, and here's those cortical radiates, and you'll notice the glomeruli coming off of those cortical radiates. All right, so one more time. Here's your arcuate artery. All of our models that have arcuate arteries have an arcuate artery running horizontal. So those nephron models in lab, they usually pick up around the neighborhood of arcuate, and then running perpendicular is going to be?
Cortical radiate.
Cortical radiate, yep. So here they call it an interlobular. Cortical radiate works just fine, but they run vertical on those models. That is a tremendous clue when you're looking at those nephron models. Arcuates run horizontal, and then let that cortical radiate run vertical. Coming off of the cortical radiate is an afferent arteriole that gives us an opportunity to travel through the glomerular capillaries back through an efferent arteriole, and that arteriole now branches and becomes a set of capillaries that wrap around your nephron tube. What is that nephron, or what is that set of capillaries called?
Peritubular.
Good. Those peritubular capillaries then link up with a vein, but we get there by way of a tiny venule. It actually has no name. So this little venule with no name links up with our interlobular or cortical radiate vein. Okay, now where do we go next? Arcuate vein. Good. And of course it lays horizontal just like your arcuate artery. From there, let's go back to our big picture. Here we are. We're coming through our arcuate veins. They sit at the base of our pyramids. We now travel through what type of vein?
Interlobar
veins. And there is no segmental veins. We go straight back into the renal vein. So there are five arteries that branch off the aorta, in sequential order. and there's only four veins that eventually take you back to the IVC. So one less vein in that pathway back out. Just keep in mind, no segmental vein, right? Okay. So what we've just done is actually the very first tracing at the bottom of your page. This is the pathway of a red blood cell through the artery and vein pathway. All you got to do is just list it from renal artery to renal vein.
Can you go back to the slide that had it?
Yeah. These two. I just gave you descriptive information on page 105 at the top.
But we need to know everything on 105. Like, that's the entire blood flow, right?
Yeah, and this is it, too. So this is clean. It doesn't have all the description with it. So if you want to just take this list here, then you've got that.
Oh, there's your list. Oh.
Yeah. So far, so good. Okay. How about questions on anything so far? All right. Over on page 106, we're going to talk about filtration at the glomerulus. Anybody still need this slide?
Okay. Hold on, go back 1 second.
That one?
Okay.
On the top of page 106, we're now going to start with the mechanism of making urine. And we start with the glomerulus because we now finally have capillaries that have a very thin wall. And we know that that is critical for making items pass across that thin wall. So let's talk about the way the glomerular capillaries are structured. They not only are thin-walled, but these are also high-pressured capillaries. You know, capillaries are going to be able to let fluids pass across. The catch is we don't want everything in your bloodstream to travel through the filtration membrane. So what we've got are these little specialized cells here. They're called podocytes, and they are described as being octopus-shaped cells. They allow fluids in your capillaries to let the fluids escape, but we don't want big stuff like proteins, red blood cells, white blood cells, or even platelets to escape. So the catch is, it's that Goldilocks thing. It has to be just right. You have to have just a large enough opening in those filtration membranes to let the fluids out, but not so large that you lose proteins and blood cells. So that's why we see a specialized setup here. We're looking for a way to push fluids out of your capillaries, capture it by that glomerular capsule, and we don't want the fluids to be reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. What we want is an opportunity to sort through and decide what you want to keep versus what you want to discard. I notice most of you do carry bags to class. At the end of the semester, have you ever dumped your bag and found gum wrappers, trash, broken pencils? You toss all that garbage, right? And then you may find things and be like, oh, I find some money in the bottom of my bag, so I keep that. I keep the good stuff like gum that still is in its wrapper, good pencils and pens. That sorting mechanism is what we're gonna do. Once you push fluids out of your glomerular capillaries, you sit there and you say, this is garbage, let it go as urine, versus this is something I want to keep, let's put it back in the bloodstream. So the glomerulus doesn't discriminate. It just simply says, here you go, this is what was in the blood plasma, you decide what you want to do with it, and it pushes it out through the wall of those capillaries. Another way I've seen this described is to think about a spaghetti colander. If you've ever made pasta and you've poured your pasta and the boiling water through a colander, what is critical about your colander? You've got to have the holes the right size, right? Because if you pour your spaghetti through and the holes are too big, there goes your entire meal. And if the holes are too small, you may get some more of that starchy stuff to stay behind that you may not want to keep. So that is the critical thing. These little holes right here created by those podocyte cells have got to be the right size to let the fluid pass through and not the bigger stuff like the spaghetti noodles, or in our case, blood cells to pass through. Okay. So you'll notice here on the top of page 106, what is in the filtrate is pretty much the liquid that's in your blood plasma. That includes good stuff like hormones and nutrients. It includes the waste products that we do want to get rid of. And it should not include big stuff like plasma proteins or blood cells. Okay, so size is an issue here. This membrane lets smaller items through, just not the big stuff, because we want to keep the big proteins, keep the big cells. Okay, so under what conditions will filtrate form? You got to have normal blood pressure to do this. What happens if you have blood pressure that's too low in your glomerular capillaries? What do we turn on? Renin, good. Where is renin made? JGA, good. And the JGA is right there between afferent and efferent arterioles, and that tube is your DCT. So where does renin travel next? And it tells the liver to release. Good. Now what happens next? Good. ACE makes angiotensin too. ACE comes back to your kidneys and it constricts. Which of your arterioles? Efferent, right. The one that's leaving. And what does that do to help your problem? Raises the blood pressure, right. So if you keep the door exiting your glomerulus shut, then that blood has to stay in those capillaries and perform filtration. So the whole goal here is to make sure that you squeeze out not just the good stuff, but most importantly, the bad stuff. Yeah, do that filtration to get rid of those toxins and waste products. All right, so that is the catch with the renin-angiotensin mechanism. In order to make sure that we can continue making filtrate, this mechanism also activates two hormones. They are good, aldosterone and ADH, good. Okay, so let's talk about this thing called net filtration pressure, which is next. And I believe I've got this picture for you in your course pack. So let's get a look at these different pressures. What you already know. Back when we covered capillaries, we talked about a push-pull battle. What type of pressure is going to push fluids out of a capillary? Hydrostatic. Good. We called it BOP, which was blood osmotic pressure, or sorry, blood hydrostatic pressure. Here we're going to change the name slightly. We're going to call it glomerular hydrostatic pressure. Same thing though, it's still blood hydrostatic pressure. So BHP is around 55 millimeters mercury. So that is pushing out of your capillary with a pressure of about 55. I know I didn't tell you guys to memorize numbers. Same thing here, don't memorize these individual numbers. All right. Blood osmotic pressure is going to be the pulling pressure. This attracts fluids to come back into your glomerular capillaries. You'll notice it's about 30 millimeters mercury. Hey, if this was the story, who is the winner?
BHP,
right. So if this was the story, the BHP is the greater pressure, it would win the battle with about overall 25 extra millimeters over the OP. So it'd be pushing quite a bit of fluids out. So we have a great push, we have a little bit of a pull coming back in, but then we've got another complicating issue. The very last pressure there is called capsular hydrostatic pressure. So this is another hydrostatic pressure. Does it push or does it pull?
Pushes.
Hydrostatic pressure always pushes. Good. So I'm just going to call it hydrostatic pressure of the capsule. And you'll notice its pushing power is 15. All right, so I need to clarify here. This particular pressure is actually pushing back into the glomerulus, while the blood hydrostatic pressure is pushing out of the glomerulus. So when you can push water out, water and all the electrolytes that are sitting out here in this glomerular capsule have not yet moved down this groovy PCT. So while they're sitting there in that glomerular capsule, they're actually pushing, they're creating a hydrostatic pressure that pushes you back into those glomerular capillaries. Thankfully, it's not a great pressure. It's around 15 millimeters mercury. So it's not really strong enough to overcome the outflow from the blood hydrostatic pressure. So this is the only thing that gives this a new twist. This capsular hydrostatic pressure is actually working to get fluids back into those capillaries. Does this make sense so far? Okay, you've got a pushing out pressure, a pulling in pressure, and actually a pressure in the glomerular capsule that pushes fluids back in. Here is the take-home message. If you have a push out of 55 and a pull-in pressure of 30, that gives you, what, a net push of 25 out, okay? This push-in is gonna work against the push-out. So there's an overall net filtration pressure of what? Of 10,
yeah.
So all of that busy background information, just to say, your capillaries and your kidneys have an overall net filtration pressure of around 10 millimeters mercury. Okay, and out of all the numbers here, the number to know is 10. Yep, and that's the same number we learned back at the arterial end of the capillaries when we studied the regular systemic capillaries. Okay, so what if your net filtration pressure was 5? Is that normal?
No.
So if that's too low, what happens next? Bingo, renin. Turn on renin, and then you've got the whole mechanism, right? So if you're under 10 millimeters mercury pressure, then you're running the risk of not being able to filtrate and push those fluids out. So yeah, that's going to activate that renin-angiotensin mechanism. Related to the filtration pressure is this next term on your sheet. Down at the very bottom, you'll notice something called the glomerular filtration rate. The glomerular filtration rate is abbreviated as GFR. So you know how certain buses and trucks in town will have on the back bumper, my max speed is 55 miles an hour? You know, that's the kidneys. The kidneys have a maximum speed, and it happens to be about 120 milliliters of blood plasma circulated through them per minute. That is it. You can drink a gallon of water, and the kidneys say, my max speed is still 120 millimeters, or milliliters rather, of fluid per minute. So you'll notice that GFR is the maximum speed those kidneys can work. Over your lifetime as you age, that GFR is going to drop. So if you're 80 years old, it may be perfectly normal to have something like 80 for a GFR. So our kidneys are not quite as efficient the older we get. Notice, though, that kidney disease is technically classified as a glomerular filtration rate of 60 milliliters of fluid per minute or lower. And if you hit as low as 15 milliliters of fluid filtered per minute, you're now in what's called kidney failure range. What is the problem with having a low glomerular filtration rate? What are you keeping?
Toxins.
Yeah, so the lower your filtration rate, the lower your filtration pressures, the higher the risk you run for keeping toxins and waste products. Those things should ultimately be pushed out into that filtrate and become urine. All right, so these are two numbers to know. The net filtration pressure is around 10 millimeters mercury, and the filtration rate for each kidney is around 120 milliliters of fluid per minute. The renal clearance is a measure of how much in your blood that you can remove over a period of time, and that's at the very bottom of your page. So if we want to estimate your glomerular filtration rate, we can do a renal clearance test to see how long it takes for your body to clear a proposed portion from the blood. So if you're taking, say, a glucose tolerance test, we would expect for you to clear a certain amount out of your bloodstream and have the blood glucose levels drop over a certain time period. Other things that are commonly used are things like creatinine, inulin. So we have other ways to inject items into your bloodstream and then see how long it takes for them to be cleared by the kidneys. If after the proposed time period you still have a high volume in your bloodstream, what does that tell us about your GFR? It's low. It's not effective at getting that particular item cleared from your bloodstream. What if after the proposed time you have a normal amount, you've returned back to where we expect you to be? What does that tell you about GFR? It's normal. Yeah, you're working like you should be. Exactly. Okay. That should do it for the bottom of page 106. How about questions so far? Are y'all ready for a break? That'd be good. Why don't we do one more topic and then we'll do a break? Why don't we do a little bit of page 107 and then we'll call it out for a break? Okay, page 107 near the top is tubular reabsorption. And what we mean here is we're doing reabsorption of items that we want to keep. The goal is, of course, to do this in the tubule system of your kidney. Okay, so keep in mind what we took out of the blood is mostly plasma, electrolytes, good stuff like nutrients, like glucose, other stuff that we don't want back, like toxins and waste products. So when we're reabsorbing, what we're doing is we're retaking those good items back into the bloodstream. So take a trip with me for just a moment. Let's travel with the molecule of glucose. That molecule of glucose starts at the renal artery, segmental artery. What's next? Interlobar artery. Then we've got arcuate artery, and then cortical radiator. You can call it interlobular artery. And then where do you go? Afferent arterial. Good. Now, we're a molecule of glucose. We're small enough to be squeezed out through the filtration membrane. So as we travel through the glomerulus, where do we go next? If you're small enough to be squeezed out through filtration, you get captured by the capsule, and from there you go to the PCT. Okay, so... If you're big, like a blood cell or a protein, you actually keep riding in the efferent arteriole. But since we're small enough for filtration, we're going to squeeze those items out and capture them by the capsule. Let those things continue on to your PCT. Okay? So when we say we're reabsorbing items, the assumption is if you're getting reabsorbed, you had to have been filtered. Okay? If you weren't filtered, then reabsorption is not necessary for you. Does that make sense? Sure, okay. If we say you're going to be reabsorbed, you had to be filtered in the first place. Okay, so if you're reabsorbed, you had to be filtered in the first place. Yeah, like right in that glomerular area.
I'm saying, can you see it?
Oh, from the very beginning. So renal artery, segmental artery, interlobar artery, arcuate, that's coming from 105 at the top, arcuate artery. What's next? Cortical radiate or interlobular, okay. Afferent arteriole, and then now we're going to be filtered at the glomerulus, okay. And because we're filtered, the next step is going to be your capsule. And from your capsule, you're moved immediately into the PCT. Big stuff stays in the bloodstream and would go to the efferent arteriole. But filtered stuff. Capsule to the PCT. Yeah. Okay, so
at page 105, really the only difference when it's filtered would be instead of efferent, it would go the capsule and then PCT.
Exactly,
and
right.
Stay the same.
That, then it depends on what we do to it that we pick a different route.
Okay.
It's going to be tracing number 3, but we're going to do it with bicarbonate instead of glucose. But you could do it with anything as long as it says filtered and reabsorbed.
Okay. I'll get you there.
I want to make sure. Okay, it will be filtered from the glomerulus, right?
Correct.
From the nephron capsule, right?
That's right. Capsule captures it.
And then it goes to the PCT.
Then you go to the PCT, that's
okay.
Right. That's right. Okay. So, since we've been filtered, now in your PCT, we have an opportunity to decide what we want to do with stuff. The chart on page 107 is all stuff we want to keep, okay? And that's all small stuff that we filtered in the first place. Now we want to reabsorb it. And a common place for this stuff is to be put back into the bloodstream. So if you're in the PCT, you're in the renal tubule. You want to be moved back into the peritubular capillaries. So, these items that are listed in the chart will be moved from your PCT into the surrounding peritubular capillaries. From the peritubular capillaries, the story's up there at the top of your page. Venule, cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar vein, and renal vein. Okay, so we did the first part of that pathway. This is just the tail end of that pathway. Okay. I got deer and headlights all over the place. Okay, so why don't we take, and let me draw this out. If you want to use page 111 again, that'd be a great place to label some of this stuff. Okay. Take glucose. Okay, we just took it from... We took it from renal artery, segmental artery. What's next?
Into lobar,
arcuate, cortical radiate, afferent arteriole, glomerulus. Okay, so because it's a small enough item, we're going to assume it's filtered here at the glomerulus, and it's going to be captured in that Bowman's capsule. Okay. And when it's captured in that Bowman's capsule, it's now going to go for a ride down your renal tubule. And the first portion of your renal tubule, let's get it out of the way there, is your PCT. Okay? So all this filtrate that was filtered at your glomerulus is going to travel down to that PCT. And this is the first of several opportunities that you're going to have to reclaim that stuff back up into the bloodstream. I kind of have a mental image of a conveyor belt. And eventually you can pull off what you want to keep, but eventually the conveyor belt just gets dumped into the urine and you've run out of opportunities to take. But that's what we're doing now. We're taking things back into the bloodstream that we want to keep. Wrapped around your PCT is a set of capillaries that came off that efferent arteriole. These capillaries are called?
Peritubular.
Yeah, peritubular capillaries. So when you say, I want to keep that, you move the item from the PCT into the peritubular capillaries. Peritubular capillaries take you to what?
Venule.
A venule, back to a cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar vein, and
renal
vein, yeah. So the goal here is whatever you filter and you want to keep right now, you can put back in those peritubular capillaries. So let's take a look at the chart. Sodium is an item that you may want to keep. Okay, so sodium is reabsorbed automatically back into the bloodstream, whether or not you need it. There's a percent on your worksheet. Don't worry about the percentage. It's something like 60 to 70% of your sodium ions get reabsorbed whether or not you need them. So if you had a really salty meal, 60 to 70% of your sodium ions are reabsorbed whether or not you need them. That kind of drives this whole concept of having a salty meal and raising your what? Blood pressure. Okay. So sodium is one thing that might have traveled this blood route, got filtered here at your glomerulus, went over here to the PCT, and is now being reabsorbed. Something else you might notice on your sheet there is glucose. Glucose will also be reabsorbed here at your PCT. And when we say reabsorbed, what is the next step? Peritubular capillaries. Okay, so what does that mean that we're going to do with this stuff? Reabsorb it, keep it, yeah. The destination is to keep it back in the bloodstream. How much glucose can you keep from the filtrate? 100%. There's a transport maximum. You can keep up to 180 units per volume of blood. That's it. So if your blood sugar is 70, how much of it do you keep? 100%. If your blood sugar is 120, how much of that can you keep and reabsorb? 100%. If your blood sugar is 280, how much of that blood sugar can you keep?
Only
180. And the rest of that blood sugar goes, guess where? Dump into the urine, yeah. So the signs and symptoms of diabetes mellitus come from having excess blood sugar above and beyond 180. And we know that water loves to follow salt, but I never told you this. Water loves to follow sugar, and if sugar is in your urine, so is the water. And so there's one of those polyuria symptoms that we expect to see. That drives the polydipsia at the other end, and polyphagia comes from losing what? Sugar, yeah, from using that sugar, losing it into the urine. So So 180 is our special transport number that we should keep in mind here. Let's see, we've got bicarbonate also reabsorbed here. So what is familiar about bicarbonate? pH, yeah. That one is the way that carbon dioxide can travel in the bloodstream, and we know that the respiratory system manages carbon dioxide. If your respiratory system isn't doing its job, or if you've got a really bad pH imbalance, your kidneys can actually make extra bicarbonate ions, which behave as a weak base. Yeah, you got it. So the more bicarbonate you reabsorb back into the bloodstream, the more base you're putting back in your bloodstream. So for what condition, what pH imbalance? Acidosis, yeah. Pull more base back in, that helps to even out that pH problem. Okay, let's see, water is taken here back into the bloodstream, as is chlorine. We call this particular reabsorption obligatory reabsorption, meaning you've got to do it. So a lot of the water reabsorption here is because we simply reabsorb it. It's present in the filtrate. We do take it back into the peritubular capillaries. So your body doesn't necessarily need the water. It's just going to take it anyway. And then finally, you'll notice amino acids are reabsorbed here, and they're important for building what?
Proteins,
good. So take the trip with me. We can pick any one of these items. Let's pick the bicarbonate because that is tracing number 3 on page 105. We're going to start with the renal artery. Segmental artery. Interlobar artery, arcuate artery, cortical radiate or interlobular artery, good. Good. Afferent arteriole, what happens to that thing there, that bicarbonate? Filter. Yep. Filter at the glomerulus. Now, you're going to forget about that afferent arteriole. Go to the PCT, peritubular capillaries, to a venule, cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, interlobar vein, and renal vein. You got it. That should be, I believe, we're going to double check. That is number 3, right? Okay. Yeah, you got number 3 down pat now. How about a break now? Brain needs a break. Okay, why don't we come back in about, say, about 7 minutes or so. We'll get started with bottom of this page. That's bottom of 107. Okay, let me get you back on page 107. So to review and repeat what we've covered so far, if filtration is the goal, where does that take place? Glomerulus, good. If an item is too big for filtration, what happens to it, the glomerulus? Efferent, yes. Nothing happens to it, no filtration, let it travel to the efferent arteriole. So when we say we're assuming filtration, that means that the item is removed from the bloodstream at the glomerulus, and what is its very next step?
PCT.
Yeah. Take it to the capsule, which flows you into the PCT. And if we say PCT reabsorption is our goal, we then move it from the PCT into...
Peritubular.
Yeah, peritubular capillaries, good. So from the peritubular capillaries, we are now back in the bloodstream. We eventually get to the renal vein, and this item, whatever it is back into full-on blood circulation. So you'll notice that what we've listed here, sodium, glucose, water, amino acids, these are all items that we should keep. They're needed for some purpose or another. So that's why a lot of the reabsorption here is termed obligatory. What does that mean?
You have to,
yep. All right, so now we get down to this hairpin loop called the loop of Henle or nephron loop. And going down the descending limb, we only have certain types of channels. Going up the ascending limb, we only have certain types of channels. We perform something here called countercurrent multiplication. Thankfully, this is not actual math. It's not real multiplication. But what we're doing right now is we're adjusting the saltiness or the salinity of the filtrate. Okay, so only in this loop of Henle or nephron loop will we perform this countercurrent multiplication. It's an opportunity for us to adjust the saltiness or salinity of the filtrate. So heading down the descending limb, we only reabsorb water molecules. Okay, so only water going down the descending limb. That means that there are only aquaporin channels there simply for water to pass back into the peritubular capillaries. That means there aren't any other kinds of channels for salt or for anything else. What is the only thing we can reabsorb heading up the ascending limb? Sodium and chlorine, yeah. Which we know commonly as salt. Yeah. So to help you keep this straight, just remember that water falls, like a waterfall, water falls down the descending limb. Okay? So that may help you keep straight that water is being absorbed as you fall down the descending limb. Salt is reabsorbed as you head up the ascending limb. So I've joked with you before about water and its various names. Water found inside the bloodstream is called blood plasma. When we squeeze the water and there's electrolytes into the capsule and into the PCT, we now call it filtrate. If you let it go as far as over here to the collecting duct, we now call that water urine. So we've got all these different names for water, but we're starting to run out of opportunities to reclaim items from the filtrate back into the bloodstream. Our last ditch effort is over here in the DCT, and that's our last opportunity to reclaim items back into the bloodstream. So we still have peritubular capillaries wrapping around that DCT, and that's about our last chance for reabsorbing items. Only items that are driven by hormonal action are going to be reabsorbed here. That means only if you need these items will they get moved back into the bloodstream. So if you flip the chart with me to page 108, tubular reabsorption of the DCT is now our next topic. Okay. So we've got aldosterone as a hormone. We know it's released when our blood pressure is too what?
Too low.
Good. What does aldosterone drive the reabsorption of? And
salt.
Good. Okay, so if you need water back in your bloodstream to increase blood pressure, then aldosterone is your hormone. It inserts sodium channels into the DCT, water follows, and then of course we see an increase in blood volume and blood pressure. What if your blood volume and blood pressure look completely normal? Do you need aldosterone here at the DCT?
No.
So only if you need increased blood pressure will you find aldosterone down there. when we started this course, I told you that aldosterone and ADH would be your best friends for this semester, and here they are again. ADH is going to be the one that encourages only water reabsorption. So if your blood is too salty, let's say you're dehydrated, that's the reason why you may want to encourage just water reabsorption back into the bloodstream. So in that case, ADH is going to be the one you want to drive water reabsorption back into the blood. So hey, if everything looks normal, you don't need aldosterone, nor do you need ADH present there at the DCT. When they are present, how do they influence your urine output? Decrease it. And what color will it be?
Dark yellow.
Dark yellow, yeah. So if these two are present, expect dark yellow, small amounts of concentrated urine. Okay. Another old friend from endocrine is PTH. What does it help drive the reabsorption of?
Calcium.
Good. So this is where the fun stuff comes into play. On the far right side of your column, you'll notice some notes. And in those notes, you'll notice things like if you've got, say, caffeine present or glucose present or alcohol present, these can all interfere with reabsorption. So caffeine actually interferes with sodium reabsorption at your DCT. That counteracts the effects of aldosterone. Or alcohol, for instance, counters the effects of which one? ADH, right. So, you know, when we're thinking about reabsorbing these items because we need them, what we're taking into our bodies can also interfere with your proper hydration. If you're a person who teeters on the edge of dehydration all the time, then, say, a diet with alcohol or caffeine is going to drive you further toward that dehydration issue. On the previous page, when we talked about countercurrent multiplication, I did want to mention to you there are some things that can interfere with reabsorption here as well. You may have heard of Lasix, which is sometimes called a loop. There you go, a loop diuretic. And that, of course, interferes with reabsorption of sodium. So if you reabsorb less sodium, what happens to it?
It goes out into the
urine, and guess who follows?
Water,
yep. So there becomes the diuretic portion of that particular diuretic. I just want to mention to you that Lasix is one of many different kinds of diuretics. There are all sorts of different kinds on the market, but that is a common one used to reduce the amount of blood volume a person has. So it acts specifically on this loop mechanism here with countercurrent multiplication. Let's see, and we did talk about glucose being an osmotic diuretic. What specifically will follow glucose if it's present in your filtrate?
Water,
yeah. And of course that water ends up where? Yeah, and you'll have dilute large amounts of light-colored urine. What does that promote happening in your body?
Dehydration.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, how are y'all doing so far? There's a lot to this stuff.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you walked in that I'd never seen any of this before.
Yeah, if I had drawn this on the board before you came in, it'd be like, oh no, I'm leaving today. Okay, one last concept here, and that is called tubular secretion. That one's found over on page 109. Okay, so some items get filtered, some items get reabsorbed. At some point, your body may say, you know what, I don't actually want this after all. I'd like to dump it and get rid of it. And there's a last and final effort to get rid of items that should end up in your urine. That is this process called tubular secretion. Notice that what we're doing is we're taking items in the blood, specifically in those peritubular capillaries, and we're saying, oh, wait a minute, you're taking out the trash, I got one more thing for you, and you dump it off into the urine pathway, and it's gone. So a lot of our tubular secretion goes into the DCT, some secretion occurs here into the CD or collecting duct, but it really is like, oh, wait a minute, I got one last piece of trash for you, and then boom, these items are now destined for the urine. This is actually opposite to reabsorption. When we reabsorb items, you're moving them from filtrate back into what?
Blood.
The blood, yeah. So we're going completely in the opposite direction. This time we're saying, oh, this is junk, get rid of it, dump it in the garbage for me. So you'll notice on the list there some familiar things that we commonly dump. Potassium is one. So let's go back to the beginning of the semester. When we first talked about aldosterone, we said that aldosterone has a sodium-potassium pump that it drives. In exchange for keeping how many sodiums?
Three.
We dump how many potassiums?
Two.
You got it. That's how this works. If aldosterone is present, you will keep the sodiums, and in exchange, you dump the potassiums. So potassium dumping is actually being driven by aldosterone. There are some diuretics that are called potassium-sparing diuretics, and they spare you the pain of having to lose your potassiums. What does potassium do for muscles and nerves? Makes them stay at rest. Yeah, so if you dump them, they're going to have a harder time staying at rest. That's why we may want to take a diuretic that is potassium-sparing. Another thing we may dump is hydrogen ions. Ah, this is good old acid-base balance, right? So why might you want to secrete and dump extra hydrogens? Acidic, yeah. If you're too acidic, dump the hydrogens. Okay, so let me tie this together with what you're doing in lab right now. In lab right now, you've talked about respiratory acidosis and respiratory alkalosis. Those are problems. Your general compensation is always opposite. Right, so it's metabolic. So if your compensation is metabolic alkalosis, your job is to make the blood more alkaline. If your job is to make the blood more acidic, then your general compensation is metabolic acidosis. So your kidneys can work as your second compensatory mechanism. There's where bicarbonate reabsorption comes into play and hydrogen ion secretion comes into play. So this is actually giving you a little touch of acid-base balance here when we talk about urinary. All right, so that takes care of hydrogen ions as our second issue. What are some other pieces of basically urine that we want to dump and get rid of here? Urea.
Uric acid.
Uric acid.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got it. And some people, they may build up excess uric acid crystals. It forms gout or gouty arthritis in the joints, which is very painful. We also know that if you've got kidney issues, that you may not secrete as many creatinine ions or molecules into your urine. You may, in fact, keep them in your bloodstream. So we can measure blood urea content as well to make sure that you're not keeping too much urea. You should be secreting that into your urine as well. So these kinds of waste products can be indicators for whether or not your kidneys are functioning properly. But nonetheless, these items may have been filtered. They may have been reabsorbed. But at some point, your body says, you know, that's just junk. Secrete it, and then now it's moved from the filtrate in the DCT or collecting duct, and it's moved from the bloodstream rather into those filtrates and then gone into the urine. So the destination for this stuff is, of course, the urine.
All right, so that is actually it. That is the main pathway here of filtration, reabsorption, and secretion. Let's do two more tracings on page 105, and then we'll have those taken care of. Creatinine from, you know, secrete that item.
Yes.
So if you're on page 105 with me anyway, start at the very top of the renal artery, go all the way down to the peritubular capillaries. Okay, page 105 at the very bottom, number 2's pathway is secretion of creatinine. Secreted items, we're going to assume, maybe were filtered, maybe reabsorbed, but let's get it from the renal artery, take it down to the peritubular capillaries. All right, and then go back to where we just were. I'm going to flip back to page 109. There's the rest of your tracing. Fourth bullet point down, once secreted. There's the rest of it. Takes you all the way to the urethra.
Okay, once you go from 105, from the capillary.
Turn back to page 109, and there it is. Once secreted, there's the rest of your pathway. Yes, do include efferent,
okay.
Yeah. You so far so good? Okay. Ready for number 4? Not yet.
Hold on. So we go from here.
105, renal artery to peritubular capillaries. And then flip to page 109. And you've got once secreted. Pick me up with the peritubular capillaries and take it to the urethra. You could, yeah, either one. Okay, about ready for number 4? Not yet. Y'all tell me when you're ready.
No,
Yeah, renal artery to the glomerulus. And then you flip to page 107 from your PCT to your renal vein. Which one? How about number four? Good? Okay, let's see. Pathway of sodium, they're filtered and not reabsorbed. We're going to start all these with the renal artery. Okay, so renal artery down to the glomerulus. I gave you time to write that. Okay, so for number four, start you off with the glomerulus, or sorry, renal artery to the glomerulus. So I give you time to jot down those steps. Okay, so for number four, we start renal artery, segmental, interlobar, arcuate, cortical radiate, afferent arteriole, glomerulus, and since we're filtering it, what comes next?
PCT.
Yep, capsule to the PCT. I'm not going to take off if you leave capsule out. Okay.
That's good because I forgot about it just now. Not going to need a scratch outside.
Actually, go back to page 103, but we got a couple of steps to add in there because we're PCT, loop of Henle, DCT, collecting duct, and then you can hit the very bottom of 103. PCT, loop of Henle, DCT. Yeah, and that's actually what's coming from page 104. I'm just reading down that renal tubule list. Collecting duct, our renal papillas next.
Renal
papillas. Yep. Yeah, minor, major, pelvis, yeah. And then you're on the way out. Okay, where'd you get that?
I got a kind of worried about these.
Okay, if you get home and you're confused, email me what you've got and I'll help you fix it. This should not be a guessing game where you have to come in and figure it out on the test. I want you to come in feeling 100% prepared on these. So if you get home and you're lost with one of the tracings, just email me. Okay. To collect and duct, and then go to the bottom of page 103, and you've got the renal papilla to the urethra down there. The last part of this chapter is just a few pages that overlap what you guys have done in lab. They start on page 112, 113, and 114. Since there's a great deal of overlap there, if you'll just read those at home, that will allow me to go ahead and do some fluid electrolyte balance with you. I think most of that is probably familiar from lab. Sure. On page 114, glomerulonephritis, that blank there is inflammation of the glomerulus. 114, there's a couple of blanks near the bottom. Glomerulonephritis is inflammation of the glomerulus. And what does diabetes insipidus result from? ADH. Yeah, vasopressin or ADH, that's right. Sure, glomerulonephritis is inflammation of the glomerulus, and the next blank is ADH. So we've got maybe 20, 15 minutes or so left, and I'd like to get you into the tough part of the next chapter. It's not tough, it's more detailed than what we've got at the first part of the chapter. I'd like to get you to page 121, and we'll do the back half first.
So is this part of the first page? Is this one different from the one that y'all have now?
It should be identical. I don't think I've made any changes to that back part.
Because the tracings on 105, they were different.
I changed them.
Okay.
Yeah, I try to change them every semester if I can.
Is that about the only thing?
For this last half year.
Okay.
Okay. Page 121 is a little intro to fluid electrolyte balance. You have been here before. Back when we covered capillaries in our previous chapter, we talked about this fluid push and pull concept. And so I just want to repeat that one more time because that's kind of where we're heading with this stuff. So what we're looking at is a capillary, and it's running through a set of cells with interstitial fluid. The majority of our fluid, in fact, is not found in the blood plasma. Where is it stored? Where's the majority of your fluid stored? Yeah, intracellular, good. There is fluid outside your cells. It's called extracellular. That includes interstitial fluids. It includes the fluids in your blood plasma. So when we're thinking about the shift in fluid compartments, we are looking at the fluid shift between the capillary and the interstitial fluids, and then the interstitial fluid shift into the cells. So the cells are hard to get to. They're going to be the last ones that we affect. So it's much easier to shift fluids between your capillary and the interstitial space first. And so that's what we're going to find when we talk about fluid movement between compartments. Nothing new so far, right? We talked about fluids. We've talked about the push-pull. So when we talk about this overall push-pull mechanism, what pressure is responsible for filtering fluids out? BHP, good, hydrostatic pressure. What battles it? Good. What creates osmotic pressure? Salts and proteins. Yes, salts and proteins. So at the arterial end, we can accomplish filtration and we can push fluids out. But by losing fluids, we lose our push power. And by the time you reach the venule end of the capillary, you now have so little push that the pull of osmotic pressure can overcome. So when we pull fluids back into the capillary, we call that reabsorption. Good. All right. All this should be same old story. We've even talked about some of that today with the glomerulus. What I'd like to do is get you into thinking about issues, problems that can arise, which comes from page 122. Y'all, so far, so good. So we've got our capillary, we've got our pressure set up here for the arterial end and the venule end. Blood is flowing in our capillary from left to right in this picture. Under normal circumstances, back when we covered this stuff, the hydrostatic pressure was around 35 millimeters mercury at the arterial end and dropped to somewhere between 15 to 17 at the venule end. Like I mentioned before, it's not necessary to memorize the numbers. If it helps you to keep stuff straight, that's absolutely fine. The other number that we're battling with here is osmotic pressure. It happened to remain stable across the length of your capillary at 26. So as long as everything looks like this, we have a normal scenario, okay? That means we're pushing out with an overall net filtration pressure of about 10. That should be familiar, right? At the arterial end. And what is our overall NFP at the venule end of our capillary?
Negative.
Negative. Okay, good. And any leftover fluids that we don't pick up are picked up by the lymphatic vessels. Good. So we've got some cells scattered out here. And here comes that lymphatic vessel traveling through to pick up those escaped fluids. Okay. This is ideal scenario. This is how everything should work. But we know that we're not in constant homeostatic balance all the time. So we're going to start with three types of dehydration. Before you came to this class today, if I asked you what dehydration meant, what would you tell me?
Fluids.
Fluids, loss of water, right? We're going to kind of turn that on its head because dehydration may be loss of fluids. It may also be loss of salt, solutes, or proteins. So dehydration may in fact be more than just losing water. Okay. Is all of this stuff familiar? Nothing's new here, right? Okay. Let me introduce you to page 122. This one is called isotonic dehydration. And isotonic, as we learned during osmosis, means equal movement of water across a membrane. Well, with isotonic dehydration, we're actually losing equal amounts of salts, solutes, and water. So the protein imbalance, the water imbalance, all of that is an equal loss. So let me play with the numbers for just a moment. To look at the numbers at the arterial end, if we knock down our hydrostatic pressure to around 25 and we lower the osmotic pressure to 10, can we still filter? Who's the winner?
BHP.
And it's the pushy pressure that causes filtration anyway. So yeah, we can still filter out here at the arterial end. Okay? At the venule end of the capillary, who has to be the winner to affect reabsorption?
BOP.
Is BOP still your winner?
Mm-hmm.
Still reabsorbing. So even though your numbers across the board are lower, we're still able to filter and reabsorb. So the case of isotonic dehydration, is that we've lost equal amounts of salt, solutes, proteins, and water, so there's no overall net change in how we push and pull the water into and out of the capillaries. So this is, of course, the easy scenario, just like with BioTrue10 isotonic water movements. There's no net gain, no net loss of water from our interstitial spaces. You'll notice some of the issues here are one-off cases. A one-off instance of diarrhea or vomiting can lead to isotonic dehydration. Fasting, not a massive bleed, but just a simple cut or something of that sort would be an isotonic case of dehydration. Easy enough? Okay, any questions on isotonic dehydration? Okay. So before we read about hypotonic dehydration, I want to go back and kind of jog your memory from BioTrue10. When cells were placed in hypotonic fluids, what happened to those cells? They swell, they bloat. Good. So who was saltier, the cell or its solution? The solution was saltier. The cell had lost salt. Okay, that's what we're going to keep in mind here. Of our two pressures, we've got BHP and we've got BOP. Which one of those two is based on salts and proteins?
BOP.
Okay, that's what we're going to think about. If you lose salts and proteins, you're going to lose BOP. And if you lose BOP, we already know that cells swell, and they get that way thanks to edema in your interstitial space. So let's play the numbers game for just a moment. Let's say that we have one of these instances here. Let's say that we've had severe diarrhea where we're losing proteins that should have been absorbed into our bloodstream. If we lose those proteins through diarrhea, then we're going to lose BOP. Instead of being 26, let's make it really low, something like 10 at the arterial end. Can we still filter at the arterial end?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're still pushing with that powerful BHP. Now, here's the problem. Down here in the venule end of your capillary, BOP should have been the winner. That should have pulled the fluids back in, but since you're 10, you're not able to battle that BHP. So no reabsorption occurs. What continues to happen down here? Filtration, right. Going back to our previous picture, the easiest compartment to influence first is your interstitial fluids. So fluids invade your interstitial space, and your interstitial space starts to bloat. What problem is this causing?
Edema,
right. The longer you let this sit, and if those fluids are hypotonic, your cells are going to burst in, and of course bloat. So not in that order necessarily, but yeah, that's the issue, is a hypotonic dehydration event ultimately leads to edema of your interstitial space, and then your cells may bloat and burst as a result. So I wouldn't memorize this list. Instead, look for my clues. Notice that almost every one of these says either loss of sodium, loss of proteins. Proteins are leaking, loss of sodium, proteins lost. You notice the pattern here has to do with losing either salt, solutes, or proteins. That is going to guide you in the direction of being a loss of BOP. A loss of BOP means cells will swell. We've got a hypotonic situation. Hey, keep the O straight. Hypo, protein has an O, BOP has an O. Okay? So don't memorize the list. I'll give you a helpful clue. I'll say I'm losing so-and-so, and that'll tell you, this is going to be a hypotonic dehydration event. Let's talk about the other side of the coin, which is hypertonic dehydration. Keep in mind, dehydration is about the loss of something. Well, you're either losing salts and proteins, or you're losing water. Okay, so hypertonic dehydration is about water loss. Numbers again. So this time we're going to leave the BOP alone. We're saying that we're not really changing those salts, proteins, solutes. That's going to stay fairly stable. What we are going to do though is lose great amounts of water. Let's take diabetes insipidus. What is the underlying cause for this condition? Loss of ADH, right. Without ADH, your kidneys just let the fluids flush on through, and you have great volumes of urine being produced. So that's primarily going to influence your hydrostatic pressure, because it's water that we're primarily losing. So since we're losing BHP, let's knock the number down. You know, maybe we're at 29 down here. Maybe you're doing a little bit of filtration. But down here at the other end of the capillary, let's knock that BHP down to 10. What are you doing like crazy now that you've got a really strong BOP?
Reabsorbing.
And the easiest place to pull fluids from first?
Interstitial
fluids. And then you can pull fluids out of your cells. And so the cells eventually shrivel as fluids are moving in a train-like fashion right back up into the capillary. Take it on tour. These fluids go to your kidneys. The blood pressure looks normal. That fluid in the filtrate gets flushed out of your body as urine because it looks like you've got normal blood pressure. So initially, you don't actually cause any reabsorption of these fluids. It's just going to be lost as urine. And then it's too late, of course, once your body realizes you're dehydrated. So the catch with hypotonic dehydration is the loss of salt, loss of water, not really the loss of salts or proteins. All of these problems can be thoroughly confusing if you think about them in a whole picture. What we're looking at is what is primarily lost first, and we're using that to determine the disorder or the fluid electrolyte imbalance. All right, so now that you've had a little sneak preview of this stuff, if you flip over with me to pages 124 and 125, I want to at least give you an opportunity, if you've got time and are interested in working on this. What I'm going to do come Wednesday is I'm going to start you back with this whole concept again. If you want to work ahead, you may want to try page 125. And then I'll work as many of page 124 as you need to feel comfortable. And then we've got to go back and hit the beginning of this chapter. But it's not anything compared to this. I want to make sure you had a chance to work. All right. Any questions for Wednesday?